I'm really excited to actually have this conversation with you. Both the podcast, but also just the work that you've been doing has really made me think a lot about some of the conversations I'm having, both with my friends, some of whom come from your generation and some of whom come from mine, and what that conversation looks like and feels like is really interesting depending on the context. And some of the things you said in the podcast really got me thinking about possibilities and opportunities and all those things. So I wanted to explore some of that with you and see, you know, where, how you got where you are and with the work that you're doing right now. And, you know, what's next in terms of that whole exploration, if you will.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great.
So I wanted to start by asking you about your own history and your own background, going back as far as the context you come from. Tell me a little bit about your growing up family and what relationship looked like in that time of your life.
Well, I definitely grew up in a sort of regular middle-class, you know, suburban Pacific Northwest arrangement. And relationship to me was fairly typical, typical for the dominant culture. That is, you know, monogamous pair bond marriage was the sort of the ideal. And, I mean, I am somewhat of an anomaly, I believe, now that my parents are still together.
Oh, my
still,
goodness.
Yeah, exactly. Still happily married.
Wow.
And so, in that sense, there was nothing necessarily wrong that I perceived from the model as it was, mm-hmm. as it was presented to me, in the relationships necessarily that I saw around me growing up. I mean, in this case, the primary one being my parents. But, you know, it wasn't until after high school that, I mean, it's interesting, really, when, you know, whenever you look back, of course, and you start to draw certain parts of your story, that you start to see, you know, the arc of how things came to be as they are. And for me, I think one of the first sort of challenging parts with the dominant model of, you know, monogamous partnership was my first high school girlfriend, which, I mean, or beyond, not this girlfriend, the first love, where we sort of had the typical high school sweetheart, you know, graduated together. And it wasn't until we started university right away. And there was a situation where a longtime friend of mine, who we had been somewhat sensual in the past, but had never really pursued anything and never dated, you know, officially. It was sort of a very, you know, playful moment when, you know, my girlfriend at the time was out of town and we just, you know, ended up somewhere. I won't say details. It didn't go very far, but it was like clearly a line had been crossed where I felt very guilty about what had happened. Like, to the point where then when my girlfriend returned and I said, hey, you know, this happened, and she was quite upset and I felt like a terrible person and am I just, you know, bad monogamist or all these questions. I didn't really have an expanded model to understand what was happening other than just, I'm a terrible person.
Right.
So there was a lot of guilt, I think, that came in and shame. And also, I do believe that was probably the part where the relationship started drifting. And we were together for another 4 or 5 months. And then it was really painful, you know, departure for me. You see, again, started falling in love with somebody else. And so that's, was, in my sense, sort of an anomaly, you know, as I saw it at the time, because then I proceeded with other monogamous partnerships afterwards, more casual in terms of length, until I met the woman who had become my wife, and we did enter the typical path. You know, we were together for 10 years in total. I got married when I was 27. Again, with this general expectation of like, okay, well, this is it, you know, monogamous partnership, this is the person you're with the rest of your life. And there's a longer kind of dual arc that happened when she, or her and I both, you know, we proceeded after we got married to say, okay, well, what's the next step? Typically, you know, is to have kids.
Right.
And we proceeded that way until we found pretty quick that it wasn't possible. Like, there was actually a biological inability on her part to have kids. Again, due to probably lots of other factors that it's a long, epic story. I will write about someday.
Okay.
But basically, we weren't able to, and that, you know, over the next few years, there was lots of attempts, you know, both Eastern medicine and all this Western, very expensive, you know, invasive hormone therapy, things like that, and it just wasn't happening. And so, we got to the point where it was this decision, like, well, what do we want to be in this next chapter?
Mm.
You know, because any couple, if they have an idea of, you know, how they're proceeding and then some milestone sometimes doesn't happen, or they don't have a shared project together.
Right.
You know, whether that's kids or whether that's a business or whether that's something.
Right.
They really, they're challenged to find something that keeps them together, I think, beyond just like, hey, we you know, we get along. So that set off through my own kind of dual exploration of being in alternative communities. You know, I've been to Burning Man 3 or 4 times at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have, I would call, you know, many alternative forms of partnership that they certainly pique my interest in. That I had suggested around that time, this was about 5 years after trying actually to have children and being unsuccessful, I suggested we try an open relationship.
Uh-huh.
And at first there was, of course, a lot of hesitation on her part, but pretty soon afterwards, she got on board and began, I think, a real renaissance of connecting with their own creativity and sexual energy. And it's always a Pandora's box. You know, people say, well, how do you, control what might happen? And of course you can. And so, you know, pretty soon after that, she did fall in love with another man and they got pregnant.
Wow.
You know, again, there's a long story behind that, but we got to the point where even at the time I was like, well, what do you actually want to proceed? Like, as in, do you want to be with this person? Do you want to figure out a new arrangement, in light of what's possible from in a community like Temera, which, of course, I learned way later. Even at the time, I was like, I didn't want to immediately flip this into the script of, I guess it's over. You know, I'm gone.
Right.
And she said, you know, she wanted to be with him, and that was it. So, and I did end up packing my stuff and leaving soon after. So that, of course, that has now informed, you know, my own quest, really, to understand, you know, what is love and partnership and how do you skillfully, you know, explore and offer and wield sexual energy and, you know, all these different things that led me to finding myself at Temera, Peace Village in Portugal, where, you know, they spent 35 years really exploring this as the core of their very community.
Right. I want to kind of go backwards for a minute and go back to that moment where you and your first love, where you realized you were having a feeling to connect with someone outside the person who was labeled as your first love.
Yeah.
At that moment or during that process, were there people who you could go to who were not part of your peer group that you could have conversations with, that you asked questions of, like, what do I do and how does this play out and what are my options? Were there people that you felt comfortable to have those conversations with?
No, not at all.
Okay.
That was definitely an absence.
Well, okay. That's not an unusual answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's you can bring it up with friends and stuff, but, I mean, and usually what happens is, because they're raised in the same structures, that they'll suggest, well, you can't do that because that's cheating.
Right.
Or you got to break up because you're obviously, you know, you must not like them as much as you think you do if you also have feelings for somebody else.
And it wouldn't have been comfortable for you, or it would have not occurred to you to go to your parents and ask them the questions?
Or someone
of their generation, like an aunt or an uncle or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's always, you know, it depends on the types of relationships you have with your parents. And I know some have, particularly around, like, you know, sexuality, that some parents have been able to cultivate a pretty, you know, honest space there, whereas I will say for myself, I mean, I did have the typical kind of sit down, you know, with the dad and, the kind of the awkward birds and the bees type stuff. That was really the extent of it. And, you know, as much as I could have stepped out more and, you know, asked, I was pretty sure that was unfamiliar territory for them.
Sure.
That, you know, and I wouldn't have thought that they could offer something that wasn't still based, again, in, like, the typical relationship structure.
Okay. The reason I ask the question is, I'm probably around the same generation as your parents. My guess is I'm probably older than your parents.
Mm-hmm.
And you've read it in the article that I wrote that, you know, part of what frustrates me is that we've created these kind of strange and understandable but still awkward barriers, because most of the people I know who are parents probably had an experience just like the one you had.
Yeah.
But wouldn't necessarily know how to have that same conversation with their own children.
Yeah.
So I'm just sort of asking that, you know, it would be really interesting if you went back to your parents now and said, what would you have said to me? You know. Anyway, so yeah, interesting. Okay, so you mentioned Burning Man, and it sounds like that was one place. How did you end up at Burning Man? How did you hear about it? What was it that drew you to it in particular?
Well, I mean, even sort of almost mundane level, I was working for a company called Matador, and they're basically an online independent travel magazine. And the founder, his name's Ross, he'd been going for a couple years. And so, you know, we got along quite well, and he said, I gotta show you guys this amazing, you know, gathering in the desert. And this is 2009, so I vaguely heard about it then. And I think a lot of the social media that has since come out, you know, viral videos and stuff about Burning Man hadn't quite hit yet. So still, like, you could tell people, you know, hey, I'm going to this thing called Burning Man. And I would say most of the people I talked to at the time would have been, hey, what's that?
Right.
Now it's quite, I feel quite different, at least in certain, you know, circles that it's like, oh yeah, of course, you know, Burning Man.
Right.
I went first time in 2009, and that certainly was a kind of introduction into a completely other, you know, universe, really. I mean, not just from going to the actual event itself, but the just alternate ways of being that were exemplified within the community, you know, both at Burning Man, but also in Vancouver. That, you know, from different events that I could go to, just really introduced me to, you know, a different way of certainly relationship. And not that there was a participation in them, but just being exposed to them, you're like, you know, you start to wonder, like, wow. It's like being in a, you know, different country and just recognizing, wow, people do things differently. They don't all do things the same way. And that really kind of got my curiosity and really showed me, I think, you know, just the challenges, limitations of the current model, and it really brought me back, I think, as well, to some fundamental questions, such as, you know, where did we first get this idea that deep partnership and sexual fidelity are, you know, absolutely hitched? You know, that it's not possible to have deep partnership without sexual fidelity is mostly an unquestioned assumption,
right?
In the dominant culture,
right?
As well as this idea that love must be finite, because, you know, if you feel some way for one person, then therefore that must, you know, take away from the feeling from another person. Like, again, another unquestioned assumption that there's only so much love to go around.
Right.
And so these questions really got me started, and then I started to look at, okay, what's below those? You know, where do these come from, these models, both in history, you know, whether the understanding marriage and property ownership and the shift to agricultural civilization, for one, but also our own woundedness around love and partnership and guilt and shame, you know, what gets smuggled in through various religious upbringings and, you know, all the rest of it, that it really just kind of opened that whole journey for me.
So it sounds like there were some real specific things that you got out of that experience of Burning Man, particularly within the timing of what was going on in your own life.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was a real opening in terms of just asking the questions, not necessarily having answers, but just getting a lot of new questions.
Mm-hmm.
How did that lead you, or how did you end up then discovering Tamara, and what were the questions that led you there?
Well, it's an interesting, you know, journey to if you start to see and like the different pieces that led to each step. And for me, Burning Man was a very clear, almost like nexus or portal into the next level of who I was to become as an artist, both with my work and where I was headed. And 2011, you know, every Burning Man gathering has a theme. And 2011 was rites of passage. And the temple that year was called the Temple of Transition, which, you know, is an understatement to say completely shattered me. The temple there, just for those who don't know, is it's really a place of grieving. It's a place of shared, you know, grief, where people will go and leave, you know, poetry or photographs or writing or, you know, old journals or, I mean, just, you know, absolutely anything. And throughout the week, people go and they write it on the walls and they pin them, you know, up, and they make little altars. But by the end of it, you're walking into this, you know, gorgeous building filled with this public grieving, right? And which a lot of it is kept hidden, certainly in dominant culture. You know, this is another way that, you know, we privatize everything. We privatize our grief and sorrow. And, you know, the impact of that is catastrophic. and you know, that's a whole other topic deeply related to this whole question.
Yeah, right. And
so it was actually the Temple of Transition that really opened up something in me that was also linked to, I remember walking away in the morning, it was going to burn, because they burned it on Sunday at the, right. the gathering in silence. And I was walking away, and my friend was walking with me, and he said, you know, what's up? You could see something on my face. And I just had this deep intuition where I said, I don't think I'm going to have children with my wife. And this was, you know, 2 years before the open relationship. This was really in the middle of, you know, the challenge and the trying of trying to become pregnant. And I just had this, you know, intuitive moment. And we kept trying for 2 years. It didn't happen, but at that moment is when I really knew. And so 2011 as well, you know, I got home. It happens on Labor Day, Burning Man, or it finishes on Labor Day. And so when I got home, it was, you know, scarcely what, maybe 10 days later that Occupy Wall Street happened.
Right.
September 17th, 2011. At the time, I was working on a film with Boko Ripper, which, you know, eventually became Occupy Love, you know, which again was a huge influence on me in activism and understanding the global paradigm shift. But it was actually early on in the occupation when I released the short film with Charles Eisenstein called The Revolution is Love, 5-minute piece. It was really a response to what I thought was not being said about Occupy at the time. Like, people kept saying, oh, you know, what do they want? Nobody knows what they want. Mm-hmm. They're a bunch of hippies. They don't want to work. And, you know, and so this piece really just says that what Charles Eisenstein had written, which was that no demand is actually big enough. Like, how do you demand a more beautiful world?
Right.
You know, how do you demand a world that works for everyone? I mean, you can hold the vision for it, but how to get there, you know, we don't know yet. And Charles calls this the space between stories. It was from that film that actually remains one of my most popular, I think it's maybe 400,000, you know, it's on YouTube or something, that Tamara actually saw this, and they reached out because they're very focused on tracking, you know, global activism and revolution and paradigm shifts. And they saw this piece, The Revolution is Love, and they reached out to me, and they said, hey, we're doing some amazing things with love and sexuality and activism and, you know, how to build a peace culture over here in Tamara. Like, will you come visit? I mean, I was certainly intrigued, but they had no funds to get over there. And the timing, you know, wasn't quite right. The story of Tamara, you know, what they had been doing there, I think this part of the thought would have been maybe it would fit and occupy love, the film. But that film really ended up focusing just on the Egypt and Tunisia and Spain and the Wall Street occupation.
Yes.
And beyond that, you know, we didn't have time to get into larger frames. And so we kind of put it on the back burner until a series of other events, which, you know, I could go on. There's just so many that led to running a crowdfunding campaign, you know, back in April with another friend, John Wolfstone, who had been at Tamara and found me through my other work with Stephen Jenkinson. And we basically said, okay, we're going to do this. And we raised the funds, you know, $23,000, and headed over to Tamara to participate in what they call the Global Love School.
So talk about, I don't want you to repeat your film. What was it specifically about Tamara that drew you? What was it about their story that really drew you and made you want to explore that a little further?
Well, what intrigued me about Tamara was the fact that they had lasted so long that, you know, like many, they started in the late 60s, early 70s on the, you know, first rush of student political movements that I think really swept the globe. And many started, you know, these different eco-villages or communes and tried to distance themselves from the dominant culture, which many knew even then that there was so much that was unsustainable about it. And I think that, you know, I've tried to study it from multiple angles about, you know, on one hand, understanding what tried to take root then and what the continued impact it has been, you know, for so many. And, you know, I meet lots of boomers that say, oh, you know, we failed, or, you know, a bunch of them went into the system, you know, after trying to start something different and then failed and then went back in. So there's a lot of kind of what I understand now, actually, brokenheartedness.
Yeah.
That, you know, and this is also where a lot of the cynicism comes from the older generation when they see things like Occupy. And they say, yeah, you know, we tried that, didn't work,
right.
You know, good luck. And, you know, I like to say to them that, I mean, so much of what was now at a higher octave that we're starting to see, you know, came from that initial first wave. And one of them, like Tamara, is a village that's ended up staying. They actually made it through the sort of initial rocky phases. And one of the things that I think was part of their success is that they put love and sexuality, understanding relationship, you know, at the core, because so much of the other ones ended because of interpersonal conflict.
Right. Oh, yes.
Right. And so that to me was intriguing, that they had placed, you know, love and sexuality at their core, and also that there seemed to be the frame of their whole place, their whole attempts, wasn't to drop out, wasn't to, you know, create this utopia that existed somewhat independently of the dominant culture, but that they very clearly had a mission, like a mission with which to research and experiment with alternative models, not just of love and sexuality, but of water retention landscapes and solar and, you know, growing food and, like so many other ways that they were, in a way, beta testing platforms and models, which they always knew they wanted to gift back to, you know, the dominant culture and everyone else in order to keep experimenting. So they very clearly had this mission to participate, you know, in this global shift. And so the second part of that was the fact that so much of American culture, I mean, in Canadian, is based upon this kind of unchallenged view of the self, right? The whole point of existence, really, since, not ironically, I think since the 60s, has been this idea of, you know, actualizing the self. And, you know, what does it mean to become your full, you know, who you can be? And there's a great film, I think it was by a filmmaker of the UK. He called it The Century of the Self, which you might have seen the film, where he really talks about how it was, in fact, the initial political movements that were crushed by, you know, the governments and the military, that, you know, we had this whole idea of we got to change the system, and so many stepped out to do so, and then when they got the crackdown, they realized, oh, wait, you know, if we don't change ourselves, how can we build something fundamentally new?
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a very noble understanding, very wise, I think, understanding, but I think what happened was it went too far, which
right.
was this idea that somehow the self needs to be perfected in order to, you know, be of use to the world.
We did the baby with the bathwater thing.
Exactly.
You know, we
yeah.
decided that clearly what we saw around us didn't work
yeah.
in terms of social modeling. And rather than accountability to community,
mm-hmm.
we had socially imposed rules
mm.
and structures. And so we decided that wasn't working. So we threw it out completely.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than saying, well, how do we reframe it in a way so that it became all about, you're not going to hold me back with your
yeah.
rules. I am now going to be completely self-defining.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting way to live on a planet.
Well, it makes me think, you may have seen this very classic episode of The Simpsons, where they have this, he's kind of a personal growth advocate, comes to Springfield, and he gives this talk, and people, you know, he says basically that message, which is, you know, we need to, all your life is about, you know, becoming the person you're meant to be and all this stuff, and
yeah.
Bart finally stems out and says, you know, well, I do what I want. I do what I feel like, right? And he latches onto that and says, wow, you know, what an amazing philosophy. Imagine we all did that.
Yeah.
We did what we felt like. And, of course, it's adopted by the entire town, and it's complete anarchy.
Right.
Right. And to me, that was a brilliant, you know, expose of that entire mindset, which is to basically have this philosophy of one of, if everybody just did the most, quote, natural thing that they wanted, you know, moment to moment, that things would work out. And it's a bit of an adolescent fantasy. You know, and that's, I think, why Bart, of course, is the foil in that whole episode. But as you say, it was so reactionary, I think, to the structures and impositions and constrictions of the culture at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, too, it was also a huge lesson, I think, going forward, that the Tamara, I think, deeply integrated, which was, it's one thing to kind of examine very systematically, you know, all of these structures of conformity and constriction, and to say, okay, you know, what's actually effective, what's skillful, but it has to be within a container of shared commitment to something,
mm.
that... without the shared commitment to building something or the shared mission, that it just becomes this kind of exercise in, yeah, doing what I feel like moment to moment. You know, there's no village in that. There's no possibility of a village in that.
Right. Interesting. So what did you learn from Tamara in terms of what have they learned that you think is really critical for culture as we experience it now?
In particular around love and sexuality?
Yeah.
Callie Lassen is the founder of Adbusters magazine. I sat with him during Occupy, and during our conversation he brought up this term, which I've used since a fair bit, called a mind bomb.
Uh-huh.
And for him, Occupy was a mind bomb.
Yeah.
You know, this is the idea that in our globally connected culture that we can release these, you know, carefully crafted messages. He calls them mind bombs that really shift, or have the potential to shift the culture.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Occupy certainly was one of those that,
right.
that was quite successful in many ways. depending on how you look at it. I certainly see it as a massive success, as a way of shifting and activating just an untold amount of other projects and other ideas and, mm-hmm. and beyond. Whereas Tamara's mind bomb for me was really looking at how do we reframe all of our understanding about human nature around love and sexuality and partnership and jealousy and scarcity and war as essentially the what's missing from our understanding of love and sexuality and partnership. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like being able to finally see what Stephen Jenkinson, my other teacher, you know, has this great line where he says, it's like building your tent in a crater, thinking it's a valley. That, and you know, your whole life, you're like, you're living in this valley that you always assumed was that's what it was, it's a natural valley. But then you realize after you climb the edges, finally, and you look down, you see it's a crater of something that happened long ago.
Right, wow.
And this is really what I see it in so much of our understanding of love and partnership mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. human nature is that we've lost even the knowledge of what we had to know what we're affected by now.
Right.
And so for me, this is really the absence of the village. And in a deep way that you know, people have different terminology, but, you know, we have this term community, which to me is a very kind of fleshless understanding of what actual village life is. Beyond nostalgia, beyond, you know, this sort of quaint understanding of borrowing sugar from your neighbor or something, there's actually something very deeply necessary in village life for humans. And the lack of the village, the loss of it, is catastrophic. And it's what's playing itself out today in both, you know, love and partnership, but also depression and the lack of rites of passage and eldership and all of these things that we are trying to respond to, not knowing actually what happened in the past, just living in the absence of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it seems to me that there's a struggle between trying to balance the sense of responsibility and accountability and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
History seems to show that we bounce back and forth between the two. And according to Gene Roddenberry, we don't get it right until the 23rd century anyway. Certainly, when you look around the world, it seems to be, do we go with orthodoxy or do we switch orthodoxies, which seems to be what we've actually done, is we've swung from one orthodoxy to the next, whatever that may be. So has Tamara found ways to kind of weave a space in the middle of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question because, you know, it's a bit like, you know, people that go to a meditation retreat, you know, the Gulf of Mexico or something, and they drop into bliss and transformation and all the rest of it. And then, of course, they come back to the culture as it is. And they're like, how the heck do I possibly live, you know, that awareness and that, you know, bliss here. So it's a bit like that. Like we off some criticisms that Tamara gets, even places like Burning Man, they'll say, well, that's great for in the middle of the desert or southern Portugal away from the rest of bigger civilization. Like it's impossible to bring back is really this criticism they level. And when I see Tamara, they're beta testing these models specifically to see how they graft on to the dominant culture and how they might actually be integrated and seeded. Mm-hmm. And just to give you now a very kind of concrete example, one of the things I really learned there was that before we can really step into alternative models of love and sexuality in a way that's responsible both to, you know, the potential fallout of exploring this way and, you know, the hearts that are just waiting to be broken, are first building spaces where truth can be spoken.
Mm.
It's deeply necessary, right? I mean, so many couples just don't even have this space to have a conversation such as, I have feelings for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, just saying that in so many conventional couples, you know, never mind that most are thinking it most of the time.
Right.
Just saying it can be just devastating for the other partner because immediately, of course, it links into this core wound, I'd say, that if somebody's already pledged their love and fidelity to you, then if they confess to having feelings for someone else, it must mean you're not that special.
Right,
that's the wound. That's the wound that gets activated.
Yes, in fact it is.
Right, and that's what happened to me. I mean, that's exactly what happened with, you know, my marriage where I said I was curious to explore in certain ways with others and that immediately hooked into that. You know, so then you got to look at, well, where does that come from? Where does that core wound come from that if somebody has feelings for another that suddenly you're not special, you're not worthy? And for me, that is another example of the absence of a village where someone's worthiness is not up to them to bestow or even one other person to say, you know, you're a worthy human being, you're meant to be here, you have a special, you know, offering and a gift to give to this time. it's not the responsibility of the person. And so as much self-love, you know, practice, training as we can, you know, force on each other, you know, they say you got to love yourself before you love everybody else. I see that as a compensation.
Mm.
It's a compensation for not actually living in community, where it's not up for question, right? Because every day you have people, you have elders who are saying, you're worthy, you're meant to be here.
Right.
Right. And so in the same way, in the absence of that, and you, if you only have one person with which to, you know, test your worthiness against, and they say, yes, you are. If there's only one person where you get sexual intimacy from, you know, of course, if they have feelings for somebody else, you're going to be devastated.
Right.
Because we've created a very scarce structure model, right, where in the same way that, you know, our economic system produces scarcity in order to, you know, drive value and demand.
Yep.
It's the same thing with relationships. And so when you start to build a space of at least truth, you know, you can just have conversations. They create a sense of willingness to see the other person. So, Sabine Lichtenfels, who's one of the co-founders of Tamara, does this great line that faithfulness is not necessarily sexual fidelity. Faithfulness is the willingness to know the other moment to moment, and how we change, right? And how, you know, who you might have married 5 years ago or even a couple weeks ago, you know, is different than who they are now. And that when we can have those spaces of truth, then often, there's also another great talk, Esther Perel, who's again making waves, you know, through her TED Talks. She has this great talk about infidelity, and she says, often, you know, most couples, for one, after infidelity, don't actually break up. That was one statistic.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was that what usually happens, I mean, hopefully, if they're, you know, willing, is that a couple starts to have conversations of truth after infidelity,
mm-hmm.
and they drop into a space of connection that maybe they haven't experienced ever, right? Because it often takes, like, this catastrophic event, like cheating, betrayal, to actually have a conversation that says maybe even, like, I feel like you know, you don't see me anymore. You know, one partner might say that to the other. Mm-hmm. Or I feel like, you know, I'm really looking for some different type of, you know, adventure or some type of sensual experience that, you know, they were too embarrassed or shameful, to, you know, to say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you have that space, then something real, something at least is truthful between a couple. And, you know, for me, death of a couple begins as soon as there's falsity. As soon as there's, you know, you're unable to speak truth, because then you just start acting out, you know, your projections of each other.
Yep.
And it's not even you're not even seeing each other anymore. And then, so to go back to Tamara, so that's the first piece. The second piece then is how do we build community with which we can speak this truth, you know, to a circle of trust.
Right.
And then this is the magic alchemy to me of Tamara, where it becomes real that the village itself shows up in the willingness to actually bear witness to, you know, our shared challenges and sorrows and heartbreak and jealousies and joy and all the rest of it. They have a very specific model called the Forum, which, you know, in various, you know, versions has probably appeared in lots of different communities.
Not to be confused with the Forum, yes.
Yeah, the Forum, this one is based on a Zeg community, which I believe was one of the precursors, or maybe a sister community to Tamara, in Germany. And it's a very powerful practice of the community sitting in a circle, and someone is invited in to the middle with which to speak whatever, you know, needs to be said. There's a facilitator / provocateur, we call them, that really helps to shift maybe more habituated ways of speaking or being from the person in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's often easy to go back into our modes of either for intellectual, you know, we kind of intellectualize everything, or for just hyper-emotional maybe, that we just sort of over-emotional and we don't really get to the core of what's actually true. And through this practice and the community witnessing, they're invited to go deeper and deeper until usually there's that truth is hit. And, you know, when you're in the circle, when you're in the practice, I mean, it's so obvious. Mostly because you start weeping. That's how you know you hit it. And by being, you know, witnessed by the community in that space, it creates this ability to really see each other, you know, as other humans. And also to recognize in ourselves, like, very similar challenges, you know, very similar heartbreaks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it really is the stitching that keeps a village together.
A couple of questions. One is, how do they then create an accountable village? How do they keep from becoming orthodox in their sense of village? We just had Mars Hill Church disintegrate here, and for me, that raised a lot of issues about my own experience of cult, which is why this conversation resonates so much with me, I think. My experience of cult was, at a particular time in my life, a search for community and safety and a space of being in a village, if you will. What came out of it was that there was an institution that grew out of it that became about power and control. Mm-hmm. And so what you ended up with was people who were labeled as elders who were in fact people who wanted, craved, and imposed their own structure. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, for so many people, if you talk about village or you talk about community, they talk about their church community or their small town or whatever,
yeah,
that can impose on its members that same kind of rule-bound structure that says you don't get to be authentically yourself because these are the rules that we impose for you to become part of our village. How does Tamara keep that from happening?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I think that particularly, again, in Canada, the U.S., and you know, others that have a very developed or fierce defense of the self, mm-hmm. that there's this real fear around, you know, relinquishing that sovereignty of the self to mm-hmm. this, you know, amorphous or orthodoxy, you know, of either a church or even, I see it even in activist groups and things, right, where people are like, whoa.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I mean, it's certainly a challenge with, you know, when you could say that the only way that we can perceive what community is, let's say, is based upon fears of what maybe we actually try to get away from, mm-hmm. you know, even generationally. This, to me, is where it's obviously so important to have certain criteria in place or, like, a willingness to surrender the truth within a community continually. And this is perhaps why mm-hmm. Tamara maybe has been successful as well, is that they really treat their place not as like, here's the community, this is the way it is, mm-hmm. but a research biotope is actually the phrase,
right,
where they are consistently like, let's say, maybe somebody has this idea of like, well, you know, what about this or what about this? Not necessarily rule, but a community norm or something. Like, let's explore that. And then we'll actually develop criteria with which to explore in the community and then kind of report back their finding. Another example is, it's my understanding that, you know, in the past they've been criticized for sort of the heteronormativity between men and women, and rightfully so, you know, certain groups, either in homosexual or even transgender, you know, groups will say, well, that's very, you know, sort of traditional, that all of your understanding frames around this men-women thing, right? When, mm-hmm. you know, that there's been leaps and bounds in understanding culturally in, you know, other places, North America in particular. In my understanding and experience, they've been very open to being like, okay, you're right. Like, it wasn't that those things were necessarily barred, like their understanding of what a gender identity is and stuff. It wasn't concretized into, no, it's just men and women. That's what we're talking about.
Right.
But they've actually been creating strides, and even what was happening when I was there, that the conversations were being had and around, you know, how do men or those who identify as masculine participate and come into good relationship with each other, which may or may not include the type of sensuality, which, you know, how do we even understand that in labels? Like, is that just simply a broader understanding of a more sensual masculine, which, you know, doesn't need an identity label of being like homosexual or heterosexual,
mm-hmm.
but,
mm-hmm.
you know, is it just a type of facet of brotherhood? And what does that mean for cultivating the depth of the feminine, you know, within mm-hmm. One who identifies as man? And so there was so much of this going on all the time that it really felt like there was a kind of willingness to continually upend what, you know, quote, was true one day and now isn't the next.
Ah, okay.
Well, I was only there for you know, about 3 weeks. And, you know, when I got there, actually, they said, well, you should be here for like 3 months. I mean, but of course, you know, with everything else going on in my life, I couldn't commit to quite that long. But I have had lots of conversations with those since, and different people, both, you know, part of the community and those who visited. And I felt given me a fairly accurate portrait of, again, this willingness and almost this, like, scientific, you know, method, really, but applying it to things like relationship dynamics and, you know, what is love and how do we study it, and that there was a willingness to continually shift. And to me, this is the piece that ensures that they don't fall into this dogmatic structures that, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, concretize and become, you know, sort of the antithesis of maybe what they initially wanted to be. And I think as well that they're kind of at that point now where they're really thinking about succession,
mm-hmm.
you know, because the main founders, Dieter Doom and Sabine Lichtenfels, are really in the process of figuring out, I think, how to have the community continue on mm-hmm. with their absence as, you know, the key figures in the place. And that certainly is going to be, I think, a real testament mm-hmm. into what the model is for governance and beyond that will allow the community to continue.
Right. Well, that was actually the next question I was going to ask you is, you know, there's nothing more telling about the success of any social or cultural experiment than how it impacts the generation that comes after its founding.
Mm-hmm.
So did you find that there were a lot of folks your age who grew up in that community, who have a relationship with that community, who are still part of it, and how do they interact within community there?
So Dieter, who's one of the founders, and Sabine, their daughter, name is Vera, who's, I believe she's early 30s, so she's about my age.
Mm-hmm.
So she grew up in the community. And, you know, for me, is, I mean, an incredible human being who has really dedicated her life as well to peace work, spent lots of time in the Middle East, in Israel, Palestine, and mm-hmm. other places, really taking up the torch now of this mission of how do we build a peace culture, you know, rooted in community. And so for me, if there was a sort of testament to what can happen to, you know, a young person growing up in something like this,
mm-hmm.
you know, she is an amazing example of that. There's even the next generation younger than that are now in their sort of teens and early 20s. Another one who's in support of, she helped with the film project when we were over there,
mm-hmm.
Who, again, was like, and I've heard from other people who had just visited as well, they meet her, who is the daughter of one of the other key fellows who runs the Love School.
Mm-hmm.
Benjamin, and his daughter is, she's one of the most intelligent, you know, sort of late teens that anybody's ever met.
Mm-hmm.
Not only in, I mean, just sort of, you know, book smarts, but also in emotional intelligence and, you know, self-worth. And, you know, certainly there's lots of sort of the general teen things that, you
right.
know, all teens seem to share. But as far as her own understanding of worthiness and capability and all the rest of it, I mean, it's an amazing intact, you know, human being that is, again, it's the same thing, is now bent at doing some amazing peace work in the world. For me, this is really showing, you know, what can happen when we raise children in environments like this.
So when will we get to see this film?
So we're in process now. The film is called A Healing of Love. I'm working on it with now my co-producer, John Wolfstone, who's going through the process now of you know, working through all the interviews and taking notes. And we actually have a call later today on looking at, you know, the first initial stages of putting together the rough cut. And initially we thought the film would be around 10 minutes, 12 minutes,
mm-hmm.
you know, similar to my other film, Sacred
mm-hmm.
Economics,
mm-hmm.
which really eliminates, you know, an alternative economic system. But given the wealth of the material we captured, it was close to a terabyte, actually, footage.
Wow.
And just some incredible interviews and visuals that we really feel we need more time to tell the story properly. So the film we're looking at now is closer to half hour.
Okay.
And
great.
Certainly late fall, you know, is a possibility, about early 2016, perhaps more likely. There will be a short release in the near term. Dieter Doom, the founder's new book, it's called Terra Nova and the Healing of Love, actually, where he's put most of what he's learned now in over 40 years in the research project and how to build a peace culture. He has a new book coming out in the fall, which a group from Tamara is going to be touring around the U.S.
Oh, great.
And, so we're also going to be releasing a short piece of the interview with Dieter as a bit of a teaser, you know, to that, and mm-hmm. as a teaser to the wider film. So that'll be coming in September.
What's next for you? What's your next project?
I'm glad you asked. In the shorter term, my major film project, which will be my biggest film to date, is Women in Electronic Music. It's actually examining, you could call it the emerging feminine, you know, in this time, but grounded in the lives of actual women, you know, DJs and producers,
mm-hmm.
And their experience, you know, being women and the challenges they have as they hit, you know, late 20s, early 30s, the time in their life when they're really becoming who they're going to be. You know,
mm-hmm.
as adults.
Mm-hmm.
And that film is called Amplify Her.
Yes.
And that will be out in early 2016 as well. And
great.
And on the cusp of that one is actually a larger film project involving Stephen Jenkinson.
Oh. Oh, cool.
And which really dive deeply into starting to emerge as a treatise on what does it mean to be at home. Mm-hmm. I mean, the case could be made that, you know, for those of us who came from the Great Migration, you know, from the quote old world, that we really, there was a lot that was lost, you know, on the voyage. And a lot of these questions around, you know, ancestry and eldership and the village and all of them, you could really trace to what happened, you know, once we came across the sea. And, you know, the sort of accepted myth is that we came here to start, you know, a new, you know, Sodor Vunu, you know, beyond the grip of, you know, these old kings and feudal systems. And yet, of course, we set about doing exactly the same thing that we left behind. And so you can make the case that we haven't actually arrived yet. And so the deeper question, of course, means, well, what does it mean to be at home? And how does that tie into this question about indigenousness?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that film itself is actually really shaping up to be an exploration of that. You know, what would it mean now, finally, to be able to be at home? Right. And how would that impact, you know, all of these other questions around climate change and, you know, environmental destruction and lack of community and all of these tied to, you know, this deeper inquiry?
I think there are some really great questions to explore in that, so I look forward to what you come up with.
Thank you. Yeah, that's looking the land closer to, you mean 2017, you know, at the earliest. But there's certainly going to be a lot of breadcrumbs left along the way.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the time and for this conversation. If you're ever, you know, down on this side of the artificial line, stop by, say hi.
Awesome.